Ever wondered how reliable eyewitness testimony in court can really be? Memory is a tricky thing. So what happens when it's all that stands between a person going to jail or walking free? Joining me today is Dr. Celine Van Gould from the University of Sydney's School of Psychology. Celine's research looks at the reliability of eyewitness memory in children and adults, and specifically how interviewing techniques can affect memory accuracy. Thank you for joining us today and open for discussion. Celine.
Hi.
Did I just butcher your name?
Kind of, but that's
okay.
Fine.
Okay. Could you tell us how to pronounce it better?
Yes. In Dutch, it would be Van Gulde.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm not
Dutch.
Anywhere near that. Okay, good. But your area of research is fascinating. It's eyewitness testimony in court cases. How did you come to start studying that?
Well, originally I started off with a law degree, and one of my electives was in forensic psychology, and it looked at a lot of things such as eyewitness memory, false confessions, anything like identification evidence. And it actually made me realize that law wasn't really my thing, and psychology might be more. So I switched to a psychology degree, and I did my bachelor's in cognitive psychology, really focusing on memory in general. And I found memory very intriguing, but specifically when we can apply it to forensic situations.
Why is memory such a tricky thing? Are we good? Are we good with our memories?
Well, even people that believe they're very good are actually not good at memory. And that's because memory is reconstructive. So unlike popular belief, I used to use the metaphor of a video recorder, but I do realize nobody owns a video recorder anymore. So I'm just going to say a YouTube video, which you can pause. iPhone video, anything. People watch YouTube, don't they?
Yes, I watch YouTube constantly.
Not at work, of course.
No.
You can pause it. People believe that with memory, you just like, you search for the one memory that you want to see. You can pause it. You can rewind it. You can look at all the details however you want. However, research has shown that it doesn't work like that at all. And when you try to retrieve your memory, a lot of different factors will actually influence what you remember and how you remember it. So even the mood that you're in at that point will color the memory that you're trying to retrieve.
So what percentage of eyewitness memory is correct? Like, is what actually happened?
I'm very skeptical at this moment about memory, but I would say unless you got actually collaborating evidence, so you've got independent evidence that can verify what happened, like photos or videos, we are very uncertain what is correct and what is incorrect.
Okay. So I would assume in a lot of your research cases, people have asked to remember events from a long time ago.
Yep.
What happens if it's not something that was current, but testimony about a long past event?
What we know from research is that like memory decays quite rapidly. So everybody's memory within the first hour, you will forget a big proportion of what you actually witnessed. So give and take like 10, 20 years, that is going to be even more and more that you'll forget. So I would say it's not very reliable for a very long period of time. Like if you remember something from very long ago, you might remember core details, but overall, tricky. With memory, unless you do something to consolidate it straight away. So we're actually doing some research in how if you write something down straight away, how that can protect your memory, even for later on. And you can go back to your notes later on. But even if you don't read over the notes that you took straight away, you're actually better protected against suggestions later on. What you see, like there's a very famous like little forgetting curve, and it shows that if you ask people to watch a video and then an hour later ask them to describe what they saw in the video, they actually forget about like 60% of all the details already in there.
Wow.
That's an approximate. And then you see it plateaus out. So then it becomes a little bit less, and they remember a small proportion of that video, and that plateaus out over time. And a problem with forensic settings or with events that have happened to you, because there can be very sudden. So if you ask for specific details, it's very difficult to remember those specific details.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things that we see often. And when we're looking at shark bites, is whether or not eyewitnesses can tell us what type of shark was involved. And the color of the shark is often the key factor. And that's very tricky.
Yeah.
As you say, these are highly emotional events. People are stressed out and bad things are happening. So
yes. Because, of course, it's a very stressful event. So if you see someone getting attacked, the stressful situation, what we found is that people that are highly aroused, so very stressed out, will remember the central details of the event better than peripheral details. So they will remember better, like, the shark and his teeth, than they would, for example, remember, what was the bathing suit that the person was wearing down the beach. And even for, just life events, everything about my childhood, I doubt everything now, unless I see a picture. But it really is. It's just a reinterpretation. It's what people have told you about your childhood. And all of a sudden, that's what you come to remember. And then you realize that's not true at all.
Yeah.
We're doing some studies with it now where people, either take a picture of an event or they write about it after they've witnessed it. Yeah. And what they actually see is that you almost, if you take a picture, it's not that you don't consolidate the memory, but you kind of are relying that the picture is there. So you're not really the storage of it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but don't know what the exact process is, but people, you see a difference with people. And now everybody's on their phones taking videos and photos, oh, I'll get back to that. But then when you ask a question, you're actually not that good at it.
You're listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that looks at research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff, and we're exploring memory and its pivotal role in criminal cases with my guest, Dr. Celine Van Gould. In cases where eyewitness testimony has turned out to be incorrect, is it more than likely because someone lied, or are there instances where people genuinely believed what they saw?
It can go either way, but what we often see with cases of wrongful convictions is that people mistook somebody that they thought was the perpetrator, or they actually created a false memory about an event. So once something is suggested to them, and due to the type of questions that we ask them, that they're asked by police officers, that they're asked by others, they can really start to remember something that didn't happen to them. But people also can come to believe that they committed a crime that they didn't do just because they've been, interviewed in a specific way.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So our memory, short-term and long-term, is bad. And then, but we, depending upon the way questions are asked, we could believe that we committed a murder.
Yes.
Okay.
What you see is there's a couple of famous cases. There's one case where a man, he's in jail at the moment still. So his daughters actually created false memories about being sexually abused by their dads. They were feeling very upset. They went into therapy, and then the therapist was asking them questions, very suggestive, very leading. And they came to believe that their dad had sexually abused them when they were children and involved them in satanic rituals and a lot of that sort of stuff. Afterwards, they pressed charges and the police interviewed him. And this guy was, he was very religious. He believed in God, and he thought, my children would never, ever lie to me, and it would never accuse me of something like that. So he started praying a lot, and then he found out during all his reflection that he was because they wouldn't lie, I must have done this, even though I cannot remember it. And he then created a false memory about sexually abusing his children, and he came to confess to a crime that he didn't commit. And then later on, a psychologist intervened and said, this is all getting a little bit weird, this whole story. Let's just see if we can make him confess to whatever and make him believe that he did whatever. So the psychologist was interviewing this guy, and he came up with all these different details, and the guy was just confessing to everything and created false memories about all these different aspects that actually didn't happen. And the psychologist said, we shouldn't believe in his confession. It's clear that he's created this false memory, and his kids probably as well. And the guy was just I truly believe what I did, and I should be punished for this. And he decided to stay in jail.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
How common is this kind of thing?
I would say nowadays it's less common, even though it can happen very easily. And it's also how you define a false memory. Is a false memory for a full event, or is it just for an aspect of an event that you believe that has happened? What you see is during the 90s, there was very much an increase in court cases where there were suggestions of false memories.
In the 90s?
Yes.
So
it happened
what was
a
going
lot.
On in the 90s?
There were a couple of things going on. So there were a couple of celebrities that came out with recovered memories. They went into therapy and then they rediscovered their memories of sexual abuse. There were a couple of books written as well that were very popular that stated things like, oh, it's very common for people to not remember any sexual abuse that happens. And if there are signs like you're a little bit overweight or you feel a little bit sad, those might be signs that you have been sexually abused. And just because you don't remember doesn't mean that it didn't happen. So go into therapy and start talking to people. And I almost want to say it was kind of the fashion thing that all of a sudden a lot of people were looking for answers to the problems that they had when they were adults, started talking to, unfortunately, psychologists and therapists, and they use very suggestive questions, sometimes used, try to hypnotize them. People become very suggestible when they are hypnotized, and then they start remembering, they pick up on little suggestions and start incorporating that into their memories.
Well, and it's probably tricky because the symptoms of one thing are probably the symptoms of a great many things.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's also just important to note, and I think you'd probably agree, that there are real cases of sexual abuse. And
oh, absolutely.
And, I mean, and so, which makes these cases even worse because, you know, you've got real cases of real trauma, real victimization, rape and whatnot that goes untalked about. Then false memories undermine the whole process.
Yeah, it's a very tricky situation, and you don't want to take away, like, even just questioning if somebody is falsely remembering something like that. I mean, for them, that is also a real thing. But then the people that have actually experienced that, it, like, you don't want to discredit any of their memories or what happened to them. So it's a very, yeah.
Well, and children are sort of unimpeachable. You know, they're you know, little kid says something, you would genuinely believe them.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with analyzing and researching child witness testimony?
Okay, so what we do is I look at a couple of different effects in children. So, for example, how repeated questioning can influence a memory and can change the memory of a child. A lot of people believe, like, oh, kids are very bad at remembering things just like adults, but they're even a little bit worse. However, they're very comparable, and even quite young kids can remember big life events. And I think I need to make, like, a disclaimer, because at the start that I said, like, our memory is really bad. What I mean is, of course, within the setting that I do research. So if you witness something and then are trying to, like, later on recall that, for those type of situations, our memories are very bad. So what is happening? And this is not to talk down the seriousness of sexual abuse. But what often happens within those cases is when children are young, it's that they don't necessarily experience the sexual abuse as immediate, very traumatizing. It is something that happened to them. And because it's going on for quite a long time and they're groomed into that situation, it can be very uncomfortable, but they don't realize it's not normal. So they kind of forget about it because it was just something that happened when they were younger. And then over time, when they grow up, they actually realize, well, this is something that was not normal. And then they reinterpret what happened to them when they were younger, and then they recover that memory, so to speak. So they never really forgot about it, but they interpreted it in a different way, and then they come to recover that memory. There's debate, though, about if people can actually completely block out a memory, and I'm not specialized into that scenario.
So tell us a little bit about is it the Innocence Project?
We call it Not Guilty.
Not Guilty.
Yes, the Sydney Exoneration Project.
The Sydney Exoneration Project.
Yes.
That started up here at the university.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So what happened is that a colleague and I received a letter from a person who was in jail. And they said, oh, we watched a documentary on forensic psychology. That's what happened in my case. And I would like you to look at my case and show that I'm actually wrongfully convicted. Having worked in the Netherlands for a Innocence Type project that used psychology students and law students to work together to reanalyze cases of possible wrongful convictions, I thought, like, oh, what if we can set up something similar over here? And this case was like the perfect start for that. So I got a group of students together, law and psychology, and to analyze this first case. And that's how it started.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What has happened? And how are the cases going? Is it improving their chances of appeal, or is it?
So often they've already gone through their appeal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they've gone through an inquiry as well. So we are trying to see if there's fresh evidence so that we can go try to like get the case reopened.
So essentially, I mean, it sort of reminds me of like the back work that happens in these podcasts like Serial, you know, or Making a Murder on Netflix or something.
Yes.
So is that good? Are these Serial podcasts making us better at understanding these cases, or is it?
It's like it's twofold. On one hand, I think it's very good because it actually gets a little bit of understanding within the community that our legal system is not flawless and that there are issues. And it's once it's like widely known, it's easier to address those issues and to actually make changes to the legal system. On the other hand, a lot of people think, like, because what you see within Serial, you see a podcast that was, I don't actually know how many episodes, it was 12 episodes, I think. But that is like years of work that they've done, and then in 12 episodes. And then you've got Making a Murderer, which is 10 years of work, all condensed into 10 hours. So a lot of people believe it's very easy, and it's just like, oh, yeah, you do it, it's super. But like Stephen Avery, the guy from Making a Murderer, is still in jail. His nephew, who was actually interviewed and then falsely confessed, which was interesting, he's like coming out now, he's just like released. But even that was 10 years, it's 10 hours that you see of it. And then people believe it's a lot easier than it actually is, that there's less to it than, there's more to it than what you see in those episodes.
Well, it has been an absolute delight to have you here, you know, even considering that these are very difficult topics. But fortunately, you've helped us make sense of it. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast. To hear more great stories, you can subscribe on iTunes and SoundCloud. Next month, Celine and I are also taking part in the university's Raising the Bar event, where along with 18 others, we'll each be discussing our areas of research to a live audience in a number of pubs around the city. For more information, head to raisingthebarsydney.com.au, where you will also find the podcasts of all the talks after the event. So if you aren't able to make it, make sure you stop by and listen to them there. And join me next time, where I'll be chatting to Amanda Salas all about the science behind a healthy diet.